Oak Session number 12096, Reel 2.
Mr. David Craig, Reel 2.
Now, you're asking about the Dover Hill. Well, I joined the Dover Hill after I'd finished my time in the Wireless College in Glasgow. I'd got my radio certificates and was ready to go back to sea, as I wanted to do. So I went to the shipping office again, sent me down to Greenock, gave me a line to join this ship, the Dover Hill. So I duly signed on the Dover Hill, took a launch out to the Dover Hill and climbed up the side and discovered that there was crates on board bound for Murmansk and Russia, North Russia. So we knew we had a Russian run ahead of us, you see.
Did anybody try to escape from the ship, avoid going to Russia?
No, I don't think so, no. No, the crowd we had, actually, we had a London, most of the officers were Scottish, but most of the crew were Londoners when I joined her. She'd tried once before and she'd broken down and she'd had to come back. And whether the crew at that time, I think the crew at that time had left her, but then they were back in Britain, so they were entitled to do that. But when I joined her, it was a London crowd, mostly London. There was a mixture. There was a few Cornishmen and a few Welshmen and a Canadian and a bit of a mixture, but basically a London crew. And we were just ready to go. We had to go to Russia. That was our job. That was where we were going. It was the luck of the game, as we used to say. If you picked it, you picked it, and that was it. So we lay for a few days in the Clyde, and then we went up to Lough Hugh in Wester Ross, which is where the convoys used to gather for the Russian run, you see. And we spent about, that was in January 43. Well, we spent 3 weeks to a month lying in Lough Hugh. Now, Lough Hugh, I've had holidays up there since the war, and Lough Hugh is quite beautiful in the summer, you know, when the good weather is. But if you're up there and there's a nor'westerly gale blowing in the middle of winter and a lot of heavily laden ships starts dragging their anchor, you know, it can be a rather tight place, dangerous place to be. But we set off on the 27th of February it was before that. That's when we arrived in Russia. We set off in February. I haven't got the dates in front of me here, but it was about middle of February, I would reckon, we left. I have the actual dates, but I haven't got them with me just now. And we set off for North Russia. There was about 28 ships with us. And when we got out, we found that we had got a very big escort. We had about, I've got it here, we had three cruisers. We had the Belfast, the Sheffield, and the Cumberland. And we had HMS Scylla, which is an anti-aircraft cruiser. And with the Dasher, which was an escort carrier, and a whole lot of destroyers, about 15, I think, the Milne, the Faulkner, the Boadicea, the Englefield, the Fury, the Intrepid, the Impulsive, the Eclipse, the Obdurate, the Orwell, the Opportune, Obedient, Pitchley, the Middleton, and the Meinl, M-E-Y-E-N-L, and a Polish ship called the Orkan. She was a destroyer as well. And then we had a minesweeper with the Jason and the Halcyon, and the corvettes with the Daniela, the Poppy, and the Bergamot. And the two old faithful trawlers, the Lord Middleton and the Lord Austin, which were basically to be get the rescue ships, were picking people up. We didn't have a proper rescue ship with us at that time. So we thought, well, by the look of this, we're going to have a kind of hard time when we set up. But the reason was that the lighter nights were coming in, you see, in the end of February, and the ice was pretty well south, which meant that we weren't going to get as far north as we'd have liked. We'd have liked to go away up Bear Island, north of Bear Island, but we couldn't do that because the ice was coming down in the summer months, and we were going to be closer to Norway and the Norwegian, the plains in Norway, you see. But we ran out into terrible weather. I've never seen weather like that in my life. And the gale in which we left Lough Hugh, it quickly developed into a hurricane. And of course, heavily laden ships in a convoy began to get damaged, and six of them actually were badly damaged and had to go back to port. They just couldn't make it. They would have foundered if they'd carried on. The Sheffield, she lost the top of her fore turret. It was torn off by the weather. The whole, you know, the armoured top of the fore turret was torn off and over the side, and she had to go back. And the Dasher, the escort carrier, she was damaged by the weather, and she had to go back, which meant that we had no aircraft cover at all. But the rest of us battered on. We got damaged ourselves. We had on deck, we had drums of lubricating oil covered with a layer of sandbags, which was presumably to keep tracer bullets from setting them on fire. We weren't very happy about that lot because there was cordite and TNT down below in number one hole below them, which was a rather explosive mixture. And in the rough weather, that was the first block that we lost. That went over the side. I mean, we were quite happy to see it go. It broke away. And we had lorries and crates. And these waves, they were huge waves, you know. You can't explain to people, but a merchant ship, at that time, a fair-sized ship, 6,000 tons, was an average-sized merchantman. You would go up the waves and right down into the trough. Well, your bow would go right under the next wave. It would go right into the next wave. And then she would shake herself free and start climbing up on the other side. Well, these crates, they were wooden crates, they would get smashed, and you would see a lorry sitting on the foredeck, you see, and he would go up over the top of the next one and down the next one and into the next sea, and when he came back up the next time, there was no lorry, it had gone, it was over the side. So we also had tanks on decks. We had Valentine tanks on deck, but they were screwed down onto welded eyelets, you know, and they stayed, but we lost most of the deck cargo. But the captain, he was determined to get there, because he said, the last time I went to Russia, he said, I ended up in a lifeboat, and he said, we're taking the ship somewhere or other this time. So we kept battering on, but the weather really was the worst weather I've ever seen at sea, that hurricane. I think a lot of books and a lot of people talk about it. Up in the bridge, where the radio officers, on that run, there was absolute radio silence, and we had to stand our watch with the navigating officers in the bridge, you see. Consequently, we had to do all the visual signalling, lamp and anything else that was required. And I remember in the East Seas trying to speak to a corvette, and it was practically impossible, because we would get up on top of a wave and she would be down, and then you would just catch her and you would start speaking to her, and then we would go down and we wouldn't see her at all. All you would see was water. And then up we would come and all you'd see was our topmast. But we used to somehow or other get the messages passed between us, you know. But after a couple of days or 3 days of that, the convoy was pretty well scattered. And the Navy managed to round us up somehow or other. I don't know how they did it, but I understand from afterwards that some naval ships, big ships, battleships, I think the Tahoe, I forget the name of them, but anyway, were in the area and they had radar. See, radar was just again in its early stages there, and she was able to plot the positions of the merchant ships, and the escorts went out after them and brought us all back together and got us bashed into some sort of shape. That was just 22 of us by that time. So we set off again for north, and then when the weather subsided a bit, of course the subs arrived, you know, and but we had such a good escort that they were able to, you know, beat them off. They never got into the convoy, they never sunk anybody. Only we used to get mines floating down between the ships. I don't know where they came from. I reckon German mine laying submarines were just releasing them ahead of us in the hope that they would do some damage. But we got a fright with one. It was my birthday, 21st of February. I got a fright. We all got a fright. We'd been in the officer's mess room. We just had lunch and we went out on deck. And my friend, the second radio officer, went to the side to throw his cigarette over the side, and all of a sudden he just stopped dead and he went flying up the bridge ladder. He never said a word, and I looked over the side and there was this huge mine about 3 feet from the ship's side, you know, midships of us, with a great big horn sticking out. I followed him up the bridge pretty quick and I found out what had happened. The ship ahead of us, I think it was an American ship, had called up and said mine. Didn't have time to say anything else, but the gun layer out in the Orlikan out in the wing of the bridge, he shouted at the officer and he couldn't get the words out. He was pointing towards the bow, you know, and right ahead of our bow was this huge big mine. Well, a merchant ship that size, you can't alter your course. It's not like a speedboat, you can't alter. Suppose you went hard a port or hard a starboard, she wouldn't answer her helm in time. But fortunately she stuck her bow down into the water and it formed like a big bow wave, you know, and the mine just sort of slid round on the bow wave and down the side. Well, the second mate who was on duty was a good sailor, and he knew that he would wait till it was coming down and then he would alter his bow into where the mine was, because that would take his stern away, you see. And we had just come out at the instant when the mine was midship, just when he was trying to pivot to get his bow to move in. But it went away astern, and one of the trawlers went out and sunk it, actually. But that was the closest I've ever been to a mine. But that was my 18th birthday, 21st of February, 1943. So we got away with that one. But after that, the subs harassed us a bit, but they never got in. But the next morning, I think, the Stooge arrived, as we called it. That was a German spotter plane. She arrived and just flew round the horizon, you know, out of range of our guns. And then we didn't have the carrier. We'd lost the carrier. So we had no aircraft to go up and shoot it down. So it just flew all the daylight hours just round the horizon. And that day, as far as I know, we didn't have any problems. But the next day we had our right first attack. The cruiser called up and said, you know, give us a warning, enemy aircraft approaching from such and such a bearing. And my action station was up in the Monkey Island. Now, the Monkey Island is a platform which is above the wheelhouse on a merchant ship. It's open to the open air. The Navy calls them, I think, an upper control platform or something, but we call them a Monkey Island. And you're just out under the sky. There's nothing above you. And I was up there, and I had the navigation officer and the captain. Three of us were up there, and we had nothing above us but the sky. Well, we got our glasses out and we saw there's three formations of plane coming in. There were seven each formation, that was 21. And at that stage you're a bit frightened, because you know, you think, gracious me, and we've all that cordite up in number one holding with TNT in number two holding, you know, we're going to be into bother. However, the planes turned round and then they broke up and each went for a ship, you see. And the one that came for us, it was a big, long, shallow dive, you know. He came right ahead of us with his bomb doors open. But whenever our own gun started firing, and, you know, you looked around and there's tracers going up from all over the place, you lose that fear. That fear goes away. You have a feeling of, it's rather strange to say this, but it's a feeling of exhilaration. You want to shout, you want to, you know. And I've spoken to other people, and it's exactly the same. When you're waiting on it to happen, fear is a thing that we all have. And it's a good thing because it makes you careful. But that goes entirely. Once the battle starts, that's gone. Well, the plane ahead of us, we saw the four bombs coming out the door, the bomb doors, and falling towards us. Well, we couldn't do a thing, because you hadn't time to alter course. The ship wouldn't alter course. They're coming straight for you. So being human, what you do is duck. And the next minute, the bombs, of course, explode. But fortunately for us, they exploded on either side. There was two on either side. And when you look up, there's water way above your head, you know, and it comes splashing down on the deck. And this is the sad thing. The funny thing also comes in. There's a merchant navy gunner with a twin Marlin machine guns, and he's in a little square box. It was a wee gun pit just after the bridge. Well, the water had come down in a solid lump and it had filled this box, and the poor fellow was up to his waist in cold water. That was the funny bit. But the sadder bit is, we looked over in the wing of the bridge and here's the gun layer standing with blood running out his mouth, you know, down the front of his duffel coat. So the captain said to me, he said, "Way down, Sparks, and see what's wrong with guns, you know." So I went down, and the gun layer, he was nearly crying, but it was anger. He was blazing mad. He says, "I've looked after this gun for 6 months." He said, "I've cleaned it, I've oiled it." And he said, "There's a J-88 going over and I'm firing, my tracers are going right in his bomb door." And he says, "The blinking thing jammed." So he had to nip round the front to get he could take the barrel off. So I forget how they cleared the Oerlikons, but he nipped round but when he nipped round the front of his shield, this bomb had exploded in the side, and a bit had hit him in the side of the face, you see. Now, I said, "You better go down." No, he said, "I'm not going down." He said, "That's nothing much. It's only my face. It's not internal." So, in television or films, it rather amuses me. Every time anybody gets wounded, the battle mysteriously dies down round about you, and you get going and lifting their head up and telling them all about it and looking after them. That doesn't happen in practice. The old man shouts to me, "Come back, Sparks, come up quick, there's another lot coming in." So he had to get back up in the Monkey. "Are you all right, guns?" "Aye, okay." He had to get back up to the bridge and get on with it, you see. And this is the way it went. But it's rather strange that there was 21 planes. Now, I've read a lot of books since the war, and they all vary. You get one tells you it's as few as 12, another one tells you it's 28, another one tells you it's 16. And I began to say now to myself, are my memory correct? But 3 years ago, I was down in New York at the Russian Convoy Club annual meeting. We all get together down there. And I met a lad off another ship, a cadet of another ship in the convoy, a ship called the British Governor. And he had been up on the bridge as well. That was his duty. And I asked him, I said, Jim Mitchell was his name. I said, "Jim, how many planes came in that first attack?" And he said, "There was three formations and there was seven in each formation." I said, "You're dead right, fella." I said, "That's 21. That's what I always believed it to be. But if you read all the books, they're all different, you see. But then again, the reason for that is I was in a position, some people might think a dangerous position, but I much preferred being up there than to being down below. The men I have the greatest respect for are engineers down in the engine room, because they don't know what's happening. They hear gunfire, and then they hear the thunderous explosion of a bomb alongside, and a merchant ship has thin shell plating, you know, thin steel plating on it. It's not like a Navy ship with armor on it. And all they hear is this tremendous explosion. They don't know where they're hit. They don't know what's happened. The old ship shudders and jumps. And I have great respect for them down below. But I was quite happy after that fella telling me that. He was an officer after that, but he was a cadet at that time. And he said it was 21, so I'm sticking to my guns. It was 21. But if you read all the different books, you'll get different numbers. But then again, as I say, it's people giving accounts who perhaps weren't in a position where they could actually see what came in. And then everything's up in the air. You don't know where you are. Well, ship got damaged a wee bit. We took a list because we began to take water down below in some of the tanks down below, you know, that were leaking with the concussion of the bombs. But we just pumped out. We kept going. It was no bother. We just carried on. Well, after... Next day, I think we had attack. Next day was rather funny. I'm an optimist, as you've probably gathered, and you always look at the funny sides, you know. But the next day, we're up in the action stations again, and it was clouds above our heads, and we saw the belly of a Fokker Wolf Condor coming out of the clouds. You know, they're great. They were huge, big planes. So the gunners on the wings of the bridge, they promptly opened fire, you see. And the next minute, his bomb doors were open. There was about 15 bombs came down. Well, they weren't coming on us because it was above our head, you see. But the captain turns to the gunners and he says, "Guns," he said, "leave him alone. He wasn't doing you any harm." But it was just, these are the things you remember. I remember the funny things. You've got to in life. If you go along life thinking of you know, all the grim things. And I mean, there was grim things that happened. But you can't dwell on them, or it's not good for you. You've got to look at the funny side and remember the good things, because that's what life's made up of. But after that, if we got snowstorms, they were quite welcome, because they were a bit of a nuisance for keeping position in convoy. Well, the enemies couldn't see you see. And we got off the Kola Inlet on the 27th of February, and the convoy, 15 of us went into the Kola Inlet, and the rest went round to the White Sea. So the Navy took us into just opposite Polyarno. That was the seagoing escorts, the deep sea escorts, and then they left us. And we picked up the pilot and set off up the inlet, up to the town of Murmansk, which is quite a little bit up the Kola Inlet. Now, we were all tired, we were all very tired, because for the last 5 days we'd either, you'd be on duty for 4 hours and then you'd just come off and just get your head down, and the action stations would sound, so you were back on again. You were maybe standing at action stations, maybe not doing very much, but you had to be there, and then it would come round for your time to go back and watch again, and that was the way it went. So after 4 or 5 days of that, we were pretty tired. So when we got into the Kola Inlet, we thought, well, we'll get up to Murmansk, we'll get a rest, you see. So we picked up the pilot and we set off up the inlet. Well, about a few miles up the inlet, we passed a British merchant ship on fire, you know, and the crew taken to the boats. So we said to the pilot, what happened to him? So he never batted an eyelid. He said, oh, well, on the way down, he was getting bombed, and he said, they must have hit him, that's all. It was a matter of a common occurrence, evidently, there. So we began to realise that we weren't going to get that sleep we were looking forward to. So we went on up to Murmansk, and we anchored just off the port of Murmansk. And, of course, whenever we were anchored there, the air raid started on the shipping and on the port. Murmansk had been bombed quite extensively. But we went alongside and we started to discharge, and that was quite a dangerous time, because they were bombing the port. In fact, the Ocean Freedom, she was just astern of us, and she was bombed alongside the quay, and she sank. But she sank level, her decks were just about, she sank below the water, but her upper works were level with the quay, you see, and the crew all got off. Nobody lost their lives in that. And the Russians were able to take the tanks out, the holes, you know, they sent divers down, hooked them on and fished them out. They were all sealed. These tanks at that time, they were all hermetically sealed. They could be covered with water, but they were still dry inside, you see, because we used to see them bring them out the water and putting them in the quay and then stripping all the tape off and everything, you know. And the Russians would go in and start them, and they would start even after being under the water. But the time in Murmansk, well, alongside the quay, I hope I'm not talking too much here, but this TNT was the bane of our life. We had it out on the quay, and we had it stacked up, you know, on the quay. So it was my job that night. I was sort of fire f- fire officer, we called him. I was fire watch. I had two sailors with me to put out incendiaries that landed aboard. And the Germans dropped what we called a breadbasket. That was a bomb that used to split open and shout out maybe, I don't know how many incendiaries, 20, 30 incendiaries. Well, one landed bang on the quay and shouted out the incendiaries in among our TNT, you see. So I ran down the accommodation ladder and a couple of sailors behind me. When I got to the bottom, I could see them. It was burning on the boxes and round about the boxes. And I think the wee sailor was more scared than I was. And he says, what are you going to do now, sir? I said, look, get back up that ladder out the road and in behind the steel bulwarks till we see what happens. So we did that. We got up aboard. Nothing we could do down there. And we were just waiting on the bang because summer was bound to go up. But nothing went up for about a minute. So we thought we'd better have a look. And a Russian party had arrived. And they were scraping the blazing magnesium off the boxes and shoveling snow on, and they got away with it. You know, we never lost anything that night. But I think the next night we did have a box car was hit in the quay and it exploded. But fortunately the keys were wooden keys, they weren't concrete keys, you know, they were made of wood, and most of the explosion went down and up and it blew a huge hole in the quay, but it didn't do a great lot of damage sideways, if you understand what I mean. But I'll tell you another joke about that. This TNT was the bane of our life. We'd been ashore a couple of nights later, I forget, and we were coming back to the ship. There was maybe about half a dozen of us, and we got back near the docks and they started bombing the docks. So of course there was a train, you see, and we nipped under the train, you know, down in the, or we were lying on the railway line, we were nosing the snow and the bombs were going off round about us. So the raid passed and I climbed out and I looked at the truck I was under and I said, hey fellas, look at this. It was a truck of petrol truck, you know, a great big container, a big long container with petrol in it. So there was a boxcar next to it and the lads came out of that and they opened the door of the boxcar and it was stacked from the bottom to the top with our TNT. And yet we'd been lying underneath that with our nose in the ground thinking we were safe, you know. But that's the way the things that happen. But no, you never, I don't think, you know, you ask, I don't know, fear is a thing that, it's a natural thing, and if you don't have fear, I don't know anyone that doesn't have fear, you would be, fear makes you cautious, put it that way, but you've got to overcome your fear, and you've got to look on the bright side. I mean, if you looked on the dull side, gracious me, you'd have gone off your nut. It's as simple as that. But these are just the funny things. But we lay there. Oh, I can't tell you the actual dates, but we lay there and then we went down the inlet, you know, and we got down the inlet. The problem was it's a long, narrow fjord, the Kola Inlet, and it's very deep water, so the ships consequently had to anchor on either side of the inlet, and there would maybe be a mile between you. And we happened to be on the side which was next to the German lines, which were only 10 kilometres away. At night, you used to see the gunfire up in the front, and you could hear the gunfire if the wind was in the right direction. Now, our biggest problem there was ME-109 fighter bombers that used to come over the hill on the far side and down the hillside and across the inlet at the ships. And they were only flying, I'm not exaggerating, they were flying, we'd to fire down on them from the bridge. They'd be maybe 20 feet above the water with a bomb under their fuselage, you see. Well, as they came to the ship, they would nip up over the top and let go of the bomb, you see. And it was these little skirmishes, they used to only last maybe, 30 seconds or a minute, but they went on and on and on, and we had gunners wounded and we had damage done to the ship. They never did a great lot of damage, the ME-109s, but some ships were damaged. But the day we finally got caught was the 6th of March in 1943, a Sunday morning about 11 o'clock. I was in the officer's mess room. I was playing chess, of all things. I'm not an expert in chess, but the Russians played a lot of chess, and of course we had to learn to play chess too when we were there. And about 10:45 in the morning, action stations went, the bells went for action station, and our guns opened up at the same time. Well, in port, there was no need to go to your action station up in the Monkey Island because you wouldn't do any good. I used to help the chief steward if there was anyone injured, tie them up. So what I did was I went through the pantry at the after end of our mess room and I looked out. There's a big teak door. I looked out the teak door and I saw two Ju-88s coming up astern of us, quite high up in the air. And our Bofor was slamming away at them, but the shells were bursting below it, you see, and I thought, well, they're a good height. So when they were still astern of us, they banked away, you see, banked off, and I thought, oh, well, we've beaten them off. And I did a daft thing. I went out on deck and shut the door and watched to see where they were going. But what I didn't realise was that before they had banked off, they'd both released their bomb load. And on the way down was 2,000 pound bombs and 400 or 500 pound bombs. Well, the 500 pounders went off on the one side and a 1,000 pounder went off on the other side, and I was blown off my feet. And I was picking myself up and rubbing the back of my head, I think, and saying some probably unparliamentary things about the German, when the gun layer came tearing down from the bridge, and he says, "You all right, Spy?" "I'm fine." He says, "Look behind you." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "It went right through the deck." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Look behind you." And I looked behind me, and just a few yards from me, there was a nice big round hole in the steel deck, you know, where the fourth bomb, the big one, the 1,000-pounder, which we didn't know at that time, had gone right through the deck, you know. So I thought, jinx, that's close, you see. So the mate came down, the officer of the watch came down, and we went over and had a look down the hole, and it had gone through that steel deck, and it had gone through the next steel deck down below, and it had gone into our coal bunkers. We had a bunker full of good British coal, which we were saving for going home. And the mate, he said, "Hold my hat and I'll go down and see where it's gone to." So he climbed down the hole, and then he shouted up. He said, "Oh, it's away in the bunker. We can't see. I hope it's gone out the bottom." So the easy way to find out if anything's gone right through the bottom is you get the carpenter or the shipwright. He sounds round with his sounding rods, you see. But we were dry. There was no water coming in. So we said, "Well, it's still in the bunkers." So what do we do now? So we called up the Navy control in Murmansk, the SBNO in Murmansk, and we told them that we reckoned we had an unexploded bomb aboard, and what would be the best thing to do. Well, he sent a message back. He said it was sorry, they had no bomb disposal people in Russia, and it was up to ourselves, in other words. So, well, the steward came out this time and said, "That's lunch up." Well, of course, food was getting kind of scarce this time, so the fact you had a bomb in your bunkers wasn't as important as your lunch being ready. So we all went and had our lunch. So after lunch, we talked over it among ourselves, the officers, and we thought, well, we'll have to dig it out. There's only one way to save the ship is somebody's got to dig it out. And if our Navy hasn't got it, and the Russians, they had bomb disposal people, but there was any amount in the town, they were busy. So after lunch, the captain lined us all up in one of the after decks, well away from the bomb over the poop. And he said, "Well, as you all know," he said, "we've got a bomb in the bunkers, in the cross bunkers. And we've got to get it out. Otherwise, we're going to lose the ship." So he said, "I'll give you three choices. One, you can volunteer to dig the bomb out." And he said, "I'm going to volunteer two. I'll be number one. So I want some of you to volunteer." And he said, "Two, you can stay aboard the ship and fight the ship." That means all the gunners, you know, the guns were aft and guns forward away from where the bomb is. "And three, you can take one of the boats and go ashore." But he said, "Now, it's entirely up to yourselves, because you all know your circumstances, your family commitments, one thing and another, and nothing will be said about anybody. What they decide to do, it's entirely up to yourself, you see." Well, you must remember, the Dover Hill was just a rather battered old merchantman by that time, but she was our home. I mean, we were sailors and she was our home. And you become a bit pig-headed and you think, well, there's no German going to make me quit the ship when she's still afloat. I'll leave her if she's sinking, but I'll not leave her when she's still floating. So you've got to put that at the back of our mind. So when he asked for volunteers, the officer next to me, I think it was the third mate, he stepped forward, and I knew he had a wife and two kids. Well, I was 18 years of age and I had no commitment, so I couldn't well do anything else, but I volunteered as well. And we got to, I think I said, was it 19 officers and men? And of course the question went around, anybody know anything about bombs? And, oh, we know they made a big bang, that's about